This is Classic Rain number 33, posted January 23rd, 2021, voiced by Will Rogers, K5WLR. The Federal Communications Commission, FCC, has kept a wary eye on the amateur radio service for decades, and occasionally hams have worked within the commission, making a name for themselves without doing so on the HF bands. One Midwest ham who has made a career working within the commission got acquainted with it as a 9-year-old. He's Ralph Haller, N4RH. Ralph was recently interviewed on QSO Today by its creator, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG. This is our first of two excerpts from Eric's conversation with this game changer.
Ralph Haller, N4RH, started his ham radio journey as a 9-year-old with a knack for electronics, leading to his first amateur radio license. Within a few years, Ralph earned a broadcast engineering license, radio station jobs, an education, and finally a career at the Federal Communications Commission. N4RH was a driving force behind many of the FCC initiatives that have had a lasting impact on radio amateurs in the USA and around the world. N4RH is my QSO today.
I have to say I had an interest in radio probably even before going to school. My folks used to tell me that they couldn't keep me away from the electronic things. I would take flashlights apart and move Christmas tree lights from one plug to another, and sort of anything that had to do with the electricity had my attention. When I was about 8 years old, I met a ham radio operator, Orville Stremple, W0UPU, now a silent key, but went over to his house and he fired up the rig and we talked to a number of stations, and I thought, this is pretty neat. So that led to me getting novice license in 1959, ultimately upgrading to extra, and I've been licensed ever since. I took a course that was given by the local radio club to get the novice license, and the instructor of that course is the one that actually gave me the test.
What was the hometown?
Topeka, Kansas, Kaw Valley Radio Club. There's a river that flows through Kansas called the Kaw River, and K-A-W, the club was named after that.
And how old were you in 1959 when you got your novice license?
I was 9.
Wow, that's actually, for those days, that was pretty young, I think.
Yeah, like I say, I was really interested from an early age. It was fascinating and got my attention.
Do you remember what your first call sign was?
KN0YMA. It was good for a year, and then I tried upgrading to general, and in those days you had to go to the FCC office to do that, which was, for me, Kansas City. Took the test, and the first time I took it, I failed the code, and second time I took it, I passed the code and failed the written, and the third time I took it, I finally passed it and got my general. Ultimately, by the time I got the general, it was like 6 months after the novice had expired, so I guess technically I haven't been licensed continuously, but I tried to be.
No, but technically you were 10 years old when you got your general.
That's true, yes.
That's very impressive, because I think in those days I remember taking the general at 16 years of age, and it was pretty hard.
As soon as I got the general class, there was no advanced in those days. It was general to extra, but I didn't go that route. I then started on my commercial licenses and got my third class radio telephone license when I was 12, upgraded then to second class, and got my first class radio telephone license when I was 13.
So you have a first-class radio telephone license at age 13. Were you needed in Topeka, Kansas by any of the radio stations there to be their engineer or at least sign logs?
In fact, I became an engineer at one of the local radio stations when I was 14, still in high school. Worked there part-time as a transmitter engineer, ultimately a combination engineer disc jockey. Then when I left for college, I went to a different station. I went to the University of Kansas in Lawrence, Kansas, and became chief engineer of the local commercial station there, KLWN. Did that for 2 years and then went back to KEWI in Topeka as chief engineer. Spent the rest of my time working my way through college as chief engineer of that station, and then did broadcast consulting for a while, built a few stations around the country, ultimately went to work for the FCC in late 1970.
Here you are, age 9 as a novice and then age 10 as a general. It sounds to me like your parents were quite supportive of your efforts to become a radio amateur, even taking you to Kansas City to get your license exams. What was their attitude?
Well, supportive is the right answer. They thought that it was a good thing for me to get involved with. I'd already made the decision that my career was going to be as an electrical engineer, and they thought that this was a good opportunity for me to get some experience, and also because of the radio club, to get to know people who were working as engineers and technicians in radio and television mostly. And so they thought it was excellent for me to start getting involved in these kinds of activities at that age, what I thought I wanted to do with my life.
This was kind of the age of Sputnik as well, right? So that there was a lot of excitement about radio in those days?
Absolutely. I had my receiver and I tuned it in and listened to it.
So what was the first rig as a novice?
I had a Hallicrafters S85 receiver that my folks bought for me, and I built a novice transmitter out of the ARRL handbook. As I recall, it was three tubes. Built it and put it on the air, and my whole novice career, I made two contacts. The first contact that I made was with the FCC monitoring station in Grand Island, Nebraska, for second harmonic radiation. I was on 80 meters, but they heard me a little above 40. And my second contact was with an ARRL official observer in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Same situation. I turned the transmitter off and did not turn it back on.
But still you weren't discouraged, and you went on to get your general class license.
It didn't discourage me, although I was concerned about going to jail if I kept the transmitter operational. I never received any more violations, so it was probably a good thing to quit using the one I made.
So you upgrade to general a year later. Did the rig improve at that point?
Yes. Again, my folks were supportive, and they got a Viking Valiant transmitter, which was a CWAM transmitter, about 200 watts.
And were you active on the air, and were you on CW or phone?
I was on both, and yes, I was active on the air. There was a group of teenagers that started a 40-meter net. We met every Saturday morning. I checked into that regularly. Some evenings after school, we would get together and talk. And I was also active in the local radio club, very active on 2 meters. The 2-meter activity originally in town was basically simplex with converted commercial equipment that had been taken out of service because the commercial equipment had to be narrow banded from 25 to 15 kilohertz deviation. So there was a lot of commercial equipment available, and then we eventually got a repeater in town. I was active in that. Most of that time, I was pretty active.
Do you remember what your 2-meter rig was?
The first one was a Motorola 80D, which was actually two separate units, transmitter and receiver separate, that hooked together with big cables, and the transmitter had a dynamotor in it, so when you had it in the car and used it and pressed the button, the headlights dimmed. But it worked, and I got it on the air, and then eventually got an RCA unit, and it was surplused from the railroads. Topeka was the headquarters of the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railway. One of the people in the club was with the railroad, and he was able to get most of us in the club some of this surplus equipment that they couldn't use anymore at a very reasonable price. So I got that and had a couple of units on the air. Then I used the 80D as a base station and used the RCA as a mobile. Continued using that actually for several years.
You're in the middle of a 2020 conversation with former FCC bureaucrat Ralph Heller, N4RH, by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for Eric's weekly QSO Today podcast. We resume Eric's conversation with Ralph in a moment. This is Classic Rain number 33. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
I remember the Motorola T-Powers, the GGTs, things like that.
Well, the interesting thing about the 80Ds is they had loctal tubes, which were pretty interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They had little tiny pins. They looked like a regular octal tube, except it was smaller pins. And when you pressed them into the socket, they really snapped in. And I guess they were made because they were concerned in a mobile environment that if they didn't have that, the tubes would fall out with the vibration. That was the only reason I could figure why they made them. It was interesting units and certainly gave me a lot of experience in terms of converting them from the commercial frequencies down to the amateur frequencies, getting them on the air. So a lot of my interest in amateur radio has really been more on the technical side, learning about electronics more so than communications. It's okay to talk, and I don't have any problem with that, but my real interest has always been more on the technical side of it.
As a 14-year-old first-class radio telephone licensee and engineer at a radio station, how are you regarded by adults who were your peers at the radio station as a young engineer there?
I was rather fortunate in that the station that I worked at was a top 40 station, and the majority of the people working there were relatively young. There were only a few people that were over 30, the owner, one of the engineers. Most of the other engineers were actually college students that were going to the University of Kansas and working at the radio station on a part-time basis. So it's not like I was 14 and working with a group of 50-year-olds. I was working with a group of 20-year-olds for the most part, you know, 18 to 25 for the most part. So it's not like I was that much different in age, and I certainly never felt that there was any kind of animosity about my age and my working there. I was accepted and enjoyed it.
Now, you received a degree from the University of Kansas?
Yes, Bachelor of Science, Electrical Engineering.
And did you go on for advanced degrees after that?
I did some work towards an advanced degree, but actually I never completed an advanced degree.
You mentioned earlier that you ended up at the FCC. How did you begin at the FCC?
Well, it was a little bit by accident. After I left the radio station as chief engineer, I went to work for a broadcast consultant in town. We built radio stations, mostly in the Midwest, and also did maintenance on them. One of the things we had to do in those days, when you were going to put a new station on the air, you actually had to go to the FCC field office, and you had to identify any other FCC-licensed facility within 2 miles of your proposed location. So I was at the Kansas City FCC office one day, and I was going through, it was actually note cards, to try and locate other stations for a new station we were putting on. The engineer in charge there, who I got to know, who, by the way, is the person who failed me in my first ham exam, but I got to know him quite well, actually. He came in and said, you know, we're hiring right now. Have you ever thought of possibly working for the FCC? I said, well, not really. I hadn't ever really thought about it. And he said, well, why don't you fill out this application? We'll just send it in, and maybe they'll want to hire you. I recommend working for the FCC. I've been here several years, and I think it's a great place to work. So I said, fine. I filled it out. I heard nothing for probably 6 months. All of a sudden, I got this letter in the mail from the FCC, and I opened it up and looked at it, and it was travel orders to go to Los Angeles, move to Los Angeles. But nothing in there actually indicating that I had been hired, just travel orders to go to Los Angeles. So I called up and they said, oh yeah, nobody told you? The Los Angeles office wants you to come to work for them. I said, well, no, nobody told me. Well, do you want the job? And I thought about it and I said, yeah, I do. I'll take it. And so my wife and I packed up and moved to Los Angeles, started working in the field office there and just thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one of those pivotal decisions in one's life that it was the right decision at the time. It was a decision that affected the rest of my life. It was by accident, sort of. I got there, but I'm glad I did it.
And you were in the Los Angeles field office from what years?
Late 70 through mid-76.
I'm sure that there's a number of hams listening to the podcast that probably took their amateur radio exam under your proctorship.
Undoubtedly true, because not only did I give exams in Los Angeles, we had Arizona as part of our territory, so I gave exams in Phoenix and Tucson, and we also gave exams in Bakersfield, California. So anybody that took exams in any of those places during those years, there's a reasonable chance that I gave them the exam. If they took a commercial exam, no matter whether I gave the exam or not, there's a reasonable chance that my signature appears as the issuing officer on their license. I was quite involved in that, although that was really only one aspect of the job, but I gave commercial radio telegraph, radio telephone, all the amateur exams. And one of the things that we had to do as an examiner is we had to know Morse code at 25 words per minute and pass it at our own test at 25 words per minute. So it required knowing Morse code and basically required knowledge of the exams, the content and all. So presumably everybody that gave FCC exams was able to pass FCC exams.
I remember that there was an FCC office in San Diego.
Clarence Spillman was the engineer in charge of that office at the time, and that's actually a sub-office of the LA office. So he reported to the engineer in charge in Los Angeles, who reported to the Field Operations Bureau in D.C. When I left Los Angeles in 76, I went to D.C., and my first job for a couple of years was in the inspections branch, where all the field offices would send their investigations, usually interference or unlicensed activity, and we would review the reports that came in and decide if there should be a fine or what actions should be taken or if the case was resolved and should just be closed. And then I moved from that to chief of the monitoring station network. We had, in that time, 13 monitoring stations around the country, one of them in Puerto Rico, one in Hawaii. And I was in charge of that for a couple of years. Then 1980, I went to the FCC's laboratory in Columbia, Maryland, and I was in charge of research at the FCC for 3 years. 83, I went back to D.C., and I worked in the policy and rules division of the Broadcast Bureau. Then from that, in 86, I went to the Private Radio Bureau, and spent the rest of my career there and ultimately as chief of that bureau. And that is the bureau that licenses almost everything that's non-broadcast, non-cable, and non-common carrier, which means police, fire, amateur, boats, aircraft, anything that, think of the two-way services, and basically it licensed all of the two-way kinds of services.
Now, were FCC monitoring stations in those days manned by human beings, or were those like remote monitoring?
They were all staffed 24 hours a day.
Is there FCC monitoring stations around the country still?
I'm not an expert in what they're actually doing now. I believe some of those stations remain open and they are operated by remote control. And to the extent that they still have field offices, I believe the field offices have at least VHF, UHF direction finding capability and some remote locations that they either dial into or can access through the internet. But I'm not directly involved with that and don't really know what the current configuration is, but I think it's something similar to what I just described.
That's our first of two excerpts from a 2020 QSO Today interview with former FCC employee Ralph Haller, N4RH. We'll continue with Eric Guth, 4Z1UG's conversation with Ralph next time. This concludes Classic Grain number 33, posted January 23, 2021. The Classic Grain Hamcast is copyright 1985-2021 Rain. All rights reserved. Classic Grain Hamcast number 34 will post February 6, 2021. In the meantime, you can download every Classic Rain Hamcast from therainreport.com. Don't forget to wear your mask, wash your hands, watch your distance, and keep on hamming.